The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. A quick announcement before we start.
We are on the 60-minute format today, so if you do have a question or a comment for our guest, Esther Dyson, please pay attention to the clock because we're 60 minutes, not 90 minutes. So those of you who would like to give us a call today, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so be patient. We'll answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com or post a comment on our blog, which is through our website, thespaceshow.com, and then go all the way over to the far right to upcoming show menu, and we're the first show listed. Open that page. And you will then go all the way to the bottom, and you can comment or ask questions. And as soon as I get your post, I will be able to bring it up on air. A couple of other quick things that I want to announce. Do look at Listen Live on the upper left menu. So remember, those are the instructions for listening to us as a live show, archive show, podcast, and for those of you using Alexa. So all of those instructions are detailed there. Please share them and pass them around with other people. To me, the most important part of this front part of the show is the fact that we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially contribute to the Space Show, and we certainly thank you for your support. So remember, as a nonprofit, if you're a federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction. The same is true in California if you make a gift to us, and we do really appreciate that. If you have any questions, visit our nonprofit parent, which is 1-ONE-GiantLeap-Foundation.org. And again, thank you very, very much for your support. Also remember, we do have corporate sponsors, and their banner ads fly across our website. Do look at them from time to time. The advertisers do change their content, and they are always delivering a new message to you. Because we're on the 60-minute format, I just want to thank our corporate sponsors. I'm not going to read their full messages, but we do want to thank the New Worlds Conference, and it is November 10th through the 11th in Austin, Texas, and the Integrated Space Plan as well. Their website is thespaceplan.com. Orbital ATK, we certainly appreciate their sponsorship. The Space Foundation and their 34th symposium coming up in Colorado, we appreciate their support. AIAA, of course, and visit their website, AIAA.org. And then Celestis, which is probably the only really proven Memorial spaceflight service with all their different services and flights. And do remember, I am their customer, and I can personally attest to there being a really terrific business and a very sensitive and caring business, too. So we do appreciate our sponsors, and if any of you are interested in corporate sponsorship for 2018, please do let me know at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our website newsletter at thespaceshow.com will be uploaded right after this show. Everything we do is archived. You can download shows very quickly, or you can also just listen to them off of our website. A 90-minute show is maybe 12 or 13 megabytes, so you can see that you can access them without very much difficulty. And I'm very happy to bring back to the show today Esther Dyson. She hasn't been with us for a few years, but we're glad to have her back. And she is the executive founder of Way to Wellville, which is a 10-year project to help U.S. communities dramatically improve the health of their residents and to develop new business models for the cultivation of health. Overall, Esther works to leverage new business models, new technologies, and new markets, both economic and political. On the aerospace side of things, she lived in Star City outside of Moscow, training as a backup cosmonaut from October 2008 to 2009 in March. Shortly after her return, she became a member of the NASA Advisory Council and later chairman of its Technology and Innovation Committee, serving from 2010 to 2012. Her investments in space include Space Adventures, Zero-G, X-Core Aerospace, Icon Aircraft, Nanorack, and Worldview. She was the first patron of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and its charter member of the Space Angels Network. She has flown weightless 6 or 7 times, mostly on zero-G, as well as once, she says, during her flight training. She now says where their goal is to get you sick, and they almost succeeded. Apart from her brief sabbatical, she is an active board member for a variety of companies, including 23andMe, Luxoft, Meetup, Press Reader, Voxiva, which is a company behind TextForBaby.org, X-Core, and Yandex, which is Russian. And you can read her full bio. It is long, detailed, and most impressive. It is on our website. But given that we are on the 60-minute format with Esther, let's welcome her back to the show. And how are you this morning?
I'm great. Thank you.
Actually, this afternoon.
Yes. Well, depending if we were flying over the Earth, what time it would be.
Esther, we were talking before the show started, and investing in commercial space opportunities does go back a number of years. We're not sure if it's maybe 2 decades or a little longer or a little less, but and you were right there at the beginning. So how have you seen it change and evolve over possibly the last 20-plus years? Because it's really a different world in 2017 than it was at the turn of the century.
Well, certainly, you know, the space itself has been around for a lot longer, but it was really mostly, you know, a couple of billionaires, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, and then there was John Carmack, the crazy game maker, and it was an antidote to the kind of large government contractors who were basically the backbone of the space industry. These were more experimenters and tinkerers and engineers. And so they were great at that. These companies tended not to be very well managed. And that has changed over time. But it took a while, partly because they were funded by their founders rather than through venture capital. In general, they didn't have outside investors, and so there wasn't a lot of management discipline imposed. So, in a sense, it wasn't really very investable. Jeff Bezos wasn't out there looking for other investors and so forth. But, again, over time, that changed. That's been one of the big changes, the fact that people realized, it's not just building rockets. We need everything from spacesuits to a company like Nanorax, which is kind of I'm an investor. I don't mean this in a dismissive way, but it's sort of a middleman. It's someone who makes big space accessible on a retail basis to everything from high school students to scientists doing research and so forth. So the industry itself has become much broader. You know, it's just like whether you're talking about space or medicine or any other industry, you not only need the experts in the field, you also need accountants and management and so forth. So that's started to happen with space.
I would then say it's easier today to evaluate and do some checking out and due diligence on a possible space investment than it probably was 20 years ago. A lot more information is probably available, plus comparable track records for comparison.
And there are research firms that put out reports. There are law firms that are familiar with space law. The whole infrastructure is vastly different. And, of course, there's the Space Angels Network for individuals and a variety of interesting startups. And at the same time, you have companies like SpaceX, which have become highly visible and scrutinized. And I would say that Blue Origin, which made a point of being kind of mysterious, is now also out in the public eye, which is great.
Do you see a winning segment that excites you more than other segments? Like, does the Earth imaging and the satellite imaging seem to be the most promising, or does the launch industry seem to be there? I don't know about human space flight yet, but what are your thoughts on the sectors?
I think people tend to focus too much on sectors, whether it's in space or other areas, and less on, is this management team going to help the company be a leader in whatever sector it is? I mean, there's clearly, in any industry, there are some sectors that aren't going to work, like buggy whips or whatever. But by and large, you don't need to be, you need to know enough to know whom to trust, but you don't need to understand the technology as long as you have somebody who can vet it. You need to understand, is this the team that's actually going to make it work? And, everybody's technology fails once or twice or has problems. The question isn't, did they start out perfect, but were they good at getting better from wherever it was that they were?
So is there a technology that you prefer? Like, are you prone to launch vehicles, for example, in the launch industry?
No. I mean, first of all, I'm not one of the billionaires, unfortunately, so I'm not out there actively investing all the time. I do sort of random things. But again, I would say that, there are lots of different market segments, and to be the winner in a market segment is better than to be number 10 in a winning market segment where you're number 10. Again, there's a lot of stuff that's needed in the space industry as in any other, and I would focus less on segments and more on managed capacity. I mean, take planetary resources. Like a lot of companies, they've changed what they were planning to do. They were going to mine minerals, and now they're going to mine fuel, and who knows what they'll be doing in 10 years. Or another one is Made in Space. A good company does something well, and then when the marketplace changes or when it's gotten sufficiently good at what it does, it goes off and does something else as well.
You have an email question already coming in from Sarah, who is in Seattle. And Sarah says there aren't very many investments for a normal investor of normal means to invest in new space or emerging commercial space companies. I'm not sure if that is good or bad. But there may be some possibilities if companies opt to use the equity crowdfunding approach. Do you have any experience with the equity crowdfunding approach? And what do you think of that as a vehicle for investing in emerging commercial space businesses?
I'm not a huge fan, honestly. I think there's a reason you don't. People can do whatever they want with their money. But at the same time, the barriers and the lawyers and all that serve to keep the market relatively, it may be slower moving, but it also keeps the bad guys at least somewhat at bay. I mean, you have examples in every industry of bad guys who raise money the traditional way as well. But, the normal investor probably does not have $50,000 to lose. And if they have $5,000 to lose, they probably shouldn't put it all into one crowdfunded deal because those are inherently risky. I mean, when I invest in startups, probably two-thirds of what I've invested in has failed. So if I didn't invest in enough things, I would have lost my money. If you know, the whole point of at least angel investing is to spread it around enough that you're going to get lucky once or twice. And to the extent I've been lucky, which is, really lucky with companies like Facebook and Google and Square, it's been luck. It hasn't been smart. I wish I could say I was really smart, but I was just, I was investing broadly enough that I happened to come across some of the good ones that gave multiple thousand times returns. But I really, you can go to Space Angels Network or something like that, but even there, you really want to invest in 10 or more deals, because if you just invest in one or two, your chances of making your money back are pretty low. And that's whether it's space travel or medicine or restaurants or almost anything.
Sort of a 10 to 1 ratio.
Something like that. The numbers vary and so forth, but it's really a game where you need to get lucky and not kid yourself that you know a lot.
I don't think the market's ready yet, but a lot of people have over time proposed a mutual fund for space investments. Do you see something like that happening?
Oh, someday, sure. We'll have all kinds of... But again, so much of the investment in space is going to end up being really boring things, like, space accounting, space garments, equipment, just like the gold rush. It's
Levi's.
I don't know how true it is, but the people who made the shovels and the jeans and all that kind of thing often made the most money. And that's why I love Nanoracks, because they saw something the market needed, which was basically a middleman between the tremendously complicated regulatory and paperwork requirements of sending stuff into space and normal people who simply didn't have the time, the connections, the knowledge, the lawyers to do that.
I have another one for you from Josh.
Okay.
This is Josh in space. Listen, Josh is in Tucson. Excuse me about that. It may be in space. I went to Arizona there for school. Anyway, Josh says, I'm hoping that there will be some space tourism investment possibilities in the near future. Do you see that as sort of opening up for more normal commercial space investment, or just for the risk takers, angels, and venture capital?
Well, it partly you need to define what space travel is. I'm an investor in Space Adventures, which was the company that organized for me to be a backup to Charles Simone in Star City 10 years ago. I'm an investor in Worldview, which takes you up in a balloon sort of to the edge of space. There's Elon Musk. Frankly, I want to be a customer of Elon Musk because I should have been an investor sooner and go retire on Mars, but not too soon. It's, for a long time, it's going to be pretty expensive as a customer. It's going to be, if to the extent that they're successful, these companies will probably go public and you can buy shares in them like like any other hot startup. And with luck, that'll happen in a couple of years.
Well, that might be risky too.
Of course it is. I mean, it's, yeah, and to some extent, people want the risk. You know, like, you can die skiing in Aspen, and people still do it.
This is just an aside, but a listener from Australia has been contacting mm-hmm. me lately, touting his desire to invest in Mars One since it's traded mm-hmm. on a stock exchange in Europe. So you can imagine my advice to him, but it's not being taken, so investor beware.
Yeah.
But investing in humans to Mars or maybe even humans to Moon would still seem a little premature. Would you sort of agree with that?
You know, again, it depends on your risk profile. On are you investing in a bunch of things? Because, you know, again, the riskier it is, the higher the payoff if you get lucky. And I mean, I was interested to hear from the guy in Tucson because I just went to visit Biosphere 2, which on a tour led by Tabor McCallum, who was actually in Biosphere 2 for 2 years. And
has Worldview too, so.
Yes, and that was pretty amazing. And it kind of, again, I think a lot of investment in space, and I'm on the board of something called Wade Peaver Labs, which is kind of doing research in this area. A lot of what we need to do to go to space effectively is going to be biology and nutrition and gardening. The two things you need to do in space are the two things you need to do in Biosphere. You need to keep the plumbing working, and you need to keep the people healthy. And those are not traditionally considered space activities, but they really are a key part of the whole enterprise.
So actually, a space related investment, those opportunities would broaden your investment portfolio because there's probably a lot of life support and biology companies that would be absolutely applicable to space travel or going to Mars, for example.
But, I mean, I guess I see myself as, you know, more than an investor. And just, yeah, there's a lot you can do in space other than be an investor, including, you know, again, I guess what I'm trying to say is there are lots of interesting jobs relating to space that are not necessarily being an astronaut. And there's a lot we need to do on Earth beyond investing to make this all feasible.
Do you think that certain going back to segments like small satellites and CubeSats, because there's a lot of contenders there. There aren't the barriers to entry are lower than other areas. Do you see that this could be a saturated industry pretty soon with too many companies vying for, their version of Earth imaging or their version of
totally.
A CubeSat?
I mean, I can't tell them apart anymore, so that's not a good sign. I mean, if I can't tell them apart, well, I'm not really very focused, but, you know, at some point the customers need to be able to tell them apart. So you have seen already mergers and acquisitions and, data companies will do different things, and different ones have different spectra and are using different kinds of satellites, but it is indeed already getting very crowded.
Another field, let me ask you about that I'm seeing, mm-hmm. I'm getting tons of emails about this all the time, is another space management consulting company has started up to advise and consult to the new space industry or the emerging commercial space industry. So I'm not too optimistic there, but are you seeing that trend as well? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, and I guess if you're referring to one in specific, I'd probably be too polite to comment. But, you know, I mean, there's clearly a need for consultants and advice and so forth. But consulting companies are, you know, the business model tends not to be one that pays back a lot of investment because it's kind of low capital, high returns to the individual talent. I mean, consulting companies traditionally are partnerships rather than investment vehicles. You know, you can turn it into a data report company and so forth. It varies, but
the ones I see are all attempting to raise funding from crowdfunding.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to position themselves as investment opportunities. And mostly what I see is that a lot of the companies that they target don't either think they need consulting or can't afford it. So I think their market is actually pretty narrow for the number of companies that I keep getting requests to do a Kickstarter program about them or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I don't typically do.
Yeah.
The regulatory environment, I think, is also very different from 20 years ago to today. So are you enthusiastic or at least okay that the regulatory environment for space is conducive to commercialization and space investment? Do you think we're on the right path regulatory-wise?
By and large, yes. I mean, you know, some of the recent announcements around space from the government have been pretty encouraging. I mean, it's still a fairly, again, it depends what you're trying to do. And ITAR is, you know, just the paperwork can be fairly daunting. And then there's the reality of certain things you can and cannot do. On the other hand, you know, in the U.S., there's at least the presumption that private industry has a real role to play, and that's not as true in most other markets where it's still very much a government-controlled business. And ironically, a lot of foreign governments are working with American companies. As a potential customer, I'm kind of glad we have a fair amount of safety regulation. At the same time, I like, you know, I think it makes sense. Okay, you know, read the disclosures, understand your risks, and if you want to go up, go up.
Another note, and listeners, I know you're using email, but it would be great to hear from you by phone, 1-866-687-7223. So this is from our friend Dr. Doug, as we call him, in Southern mm-hmm. California. He's a medical doctor.
Another doctor.
But a medical doctor, not a scientist doctor.
Yeah.
GEO commsats have been the largest part of commercial space for quite some time, yet GEO commsats haven't led directly to space settlement. It is not clear to me that swarms of Earth observation or Earth observing satellites will lead to space settlement either. So what do you see as the connection between commercial space and space settlement?
I think it's a whole different area of commercial space. I mean, commercial space is much broader and includes settlement, but that doesn't mean that swarms are necessarily, it's a completely different thing. I mean, one is, you can send satellites up to do observation and known humans need to fly. Again, the kinds of things you need to actually send people up are actually pretty complicated. As I said before, they involve plumbing and medicine and a fair amount of things like radiation shielding. And yes, if we're sending people up, we're going to be a little more careful about everything working. We need to deal with things like psychological, you know, the team members, and that's something you can talk to Tabor McCallum about. It's not that easy living with the same few people for several years. And then there's also the difference between space travel, where you go somewhere and come back, which, as we've heard, you know, space adventures, and we're doing on the International Space Station. I wouldn't exactly call that settlement. It's going to be a while, but with luck, I'm going to live long enough that I can retire there somewhere. And, you know, the older you get, the more you want less gravity so that you can stand up straight and tall.
So things like parts of the commercial space industry, like satellite communications, are not lead-ins to space settlement. That's just a totally different part of commercialization. But they're not drivers for it.
There's a relation. They're all in space, but it's a very, very different part of the whole proposition. I mean, again, because, you know, sending things up into space is only a very, very small part of the whole proposition, which, again, includes creating both capsules or pods or whatever it is you're going to put the people in, and then figuring out how to create Biosphere 3, so to speak, so that they can become self-sustaining. I mean, to me, settlement means self-sustaining as opposed to bring your food with you. And we haven't really gotten there. I mean, again, I think biology and synthetic biology and genetic engineering and things like that are probably more important, ultimately, than all the stuff we're doing with our small satellites and our large launch vehicles and so forth. You need those. But then, again, for settlement that is sustainable, you need a whole different set of capabilities.
So that has, sparked a question from Al, who is in Denver, again, by email. And
shame on them. They should call.
Yes, they should call, and they all know that I pitch for the phones all the time, and the phones are the preferred way to get us. 1-866-687-7223. Anyway, Al is saying, based on what you just said, I am wondering if the non-direct space activities, like the work in pharmaceuticals, biology, genetics, etc., are progressing at a pace and in a wide enough variety to have space application, or is the space application in these other fields really slim?
So far, it's still honestly pretty slim. Again, if you're really interested, Google Wavehaver Labs, and you can find out a little more. But, you know, as we start to think more about the environment and start to understand how plants work and how the atmosphere changes and so forth, some of that is going to be applicable on other planets or inside enclosed atmospheres. But, yeah, there's an awful lot to do, and I would say we aren't focused on it enough yet, partly because, you know, now there is a market for all these small satellites and the data they're collecting. Those of us who are enthusiasts see a huge market for all the things that are going to need for non-terrestrial settlement. But if you're kind of a traditional VC, you can't really see an exit in 5 years. So it's still going to be, you know, again, it's going to be the tinkerers and the billionaires who fund genetic engineering with vision rather than the VCs who have limited partners who want their money back in triplicate after 3 years.
Yet another email. Adrian is in San Diego. He never calls us. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
He may not know there are telephones in the universe.
Maybe he's a bot.
No, he is a PhD scientist. He's very bright. But
okay.
he prefers email. Adrian says, do you see a future role for cryptocurrency in space investment or commerce as space inhabitants and transnational industries become more numerous and begin an inevitable progressive independent divergence from the terrestrial economy?
So I think that, you know, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of the example I'm thinking of, but, you know, when cryptocurrency is just another form of currency, and it's got a distributed back end, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of like we don't talk about internet phones anymore, or we don't talk about, you know, electricity-based businesses or phone-based businesses, because you assume everybody's business is phone-based or internet-based. I don't see cryptocurrency as being a huge enabler of space. I don't see space necessarily as being a huge enabler of cryptocurrency. I think they'll sort of both happen, but independently of one another. And I think, you know, just like AI, it's kind of, it's an interesting technology, but what really matters is how, you know, what you build around it, the economy that you build around it, or whatever. I mean, cryptocurrency on its own is not going to drive stuff that you couldn't do some other way.
Is it going to be?
I mean, again, I think synthetic biology is much more relevant, I guess, to put it politely and clearly.
You mentioned AI. Is that going to be a big part of commercially developing space? And does AI raise concerns and fears for you like it does for some other people?
Again, AI is an independently developing technology that's, I mean, right now it's sort of the plain old kind of neural net pattern recognition image detection AI is a huge part of all the interest in, you know, images/data from space. Using AI to run things autonomously, whether humans are around or not, is going to be a very important part of doing stuff remotely, both in environments where people can't survive or don't want to survive or can't get to. There's a little more connection between AI and space, I think, than cryptocurrency and space.
We just had the first meeting of the National Space Council, which seems to have a bent on some sort of a policy that's going to take us back to the moon with people. Do you see that type of political activity and possible policy making as economic drivers for commercial space and new space investment? Is it helpful or ambivalent? So totally helpful.
Totally. I mean, just because attention's being paid and, you know, I might have other uses for the budget, but going to the moon is achievable, and I think, hey, it's a great, you know, it's close and convenient and plausible, and so I think it's terrific. I mean, I don't want to give up on Mars, but, you know, moon is a great next step.
Peter's in Billings, Montana, and he says, sorry, David, I can't use the phone, but I'm wondering, Esther, if you see public-private partnerships as possibly decent investment vehicles on the private side, obviously, of course, depending on what the project might consist of.
Yeah. You know, again, I hate to do this. It's one of those it depends answers. Some of the public-private partnerships make total sense. Some don't. You know, be careful that you don't get sort of lured in by, oh my gosh, the government's going to support this no matter what. There's a lot of public-private public private partnerships that don't succeed, but you know, it's always nice of the government on your side. I guess I would judge them as critically as I would judge anything else.
And not just be enthusiastic because the government's there.
Precisely.
We also hear a lot and talk a lot on the space show about the need for the development of space infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And part of that includes infrastructure on the ground. Not all of it is meant to be cislunar or orbiting the moon or something of that nature. So do you see space infrastructure, including components that may be built on the ground, as possibly good investment vehicles, to be involved in space?
Sorry, say that one more time.
Say it again, please. I missed what you said.
I missed what you said. Say the question again, sorry.
So investing in space infrastructure, including things that may be necessary on the ground, is that a good sort of way to be investing in space that's maybe not directly space?
Again, it is if the deal makes sense, because the deal makes sense, yes. Just because it's space. I mean, if you really want to invest in space, it could be one good way, but being on the ground doesn't necessarily make it any safer.
So being on the ground is sort of neutral. It still depends on what you're doing on the ground.
Yeah, it still depends. Again, I mean, I keep saying this. It depends so much on the quality of the management. My parents are scientists. I've grown up surrounded by clever people and innovation, and I am so conscious how much implementation is more important than brilliant ideas. Yeah, give me someone who can execute any day. If you can execute, you can hire brilliant people. Or the brilliant people will come to you because they've got a brilliant idea, but they're having trouble making it actually happen. So, I get investment proposals all the time from people with brilliant ideas who think that an idea is worth something. No. An idea plus a team that's committed, that knows how to... There are very few ideas that are perfect when they start out. And in a sense, the purpose of any company in management is to take an imperfect idea and turn it into something workable. So just really focus on who the people are who are going to take this possibly brilliant idea and turn it into a workable idea. There's a big difference between those two things.
So Beverly in Boston sent in an email and says, I too am able to use the phone, David. Forgive me. Esther, David frequently rants when he gets on a business kick on the show that you bet on people, not the engine exhaust funnels or anything like that.
Oh, my gosh. I thought I was so special and I was the only person saying this. Absolutely.
And he also says, while track records are not always predictors of the future, they may be a good idea. The problem is not everybody starting in a space business may have a track record in something similar to what they want to do in the space business. So can you successfully extrapolate what people have done well in the past, even though it has nothing to do with what they're wanting to do in space? Or do you need to find some similarities to make the evaluation mean something?
Again, if you're a good investor, you somehow have that knack of assessing people. You're more likely to make a huge return if you happen to be lucky and hit the person on their first deal rather than they get a seasoned veteran on their fourth deal when the market is already pricing their capacities in. But this is why they call it venture capital. I mean, at the same time, a smart person can get a lot of insight into a potential team by talking to them and seeing what they've done. I mean, they might not have experience in space, but you know, who knows? I mean, they have experience in anything from running their high school track team to, you know, who knows? But I guess what I'm trying to say is the character of the people matters, and it's not, you know, look at their CV and run an algorithm. It's actually talk to them, see how they think, how do they respond under pressure. Are they so wedded to their idea that they won't change it, even if it turns out the market gives them feedback that maybe they should change it and so forth. So people with track records, they may have a track record and then they get tired and so they don't do as well the next time, or they may have a bad track record and they learned a lot. A lot of the best entrepreneurs have had a bunch of failures. And the ones who haven't had a bunch of failures probably weren't risking enough.
So the failure itself would not exclude someone from your consideration?
No, actually, I've often invested in people who've lost me money the first time around. Yeah, I mean, there's a joke about this because this is not a thought unique to me, where there's a board meeting and the CEO is talking to his board and the head of, yeah, some, let's say the head of SmallSats, this is a big and SmallSat company, the head of SmallSats has just had a huge disaster and something went wrong. The board says, so of course you're going to fire this guy, right? And the CEO says, good Lord, no, I just spent $26 million educating him. I'm going to keep him. And that's how you learn, through your mistakes, not through being successful all the time.
Don is in Philly and also says, sorry, I can't use the phone. What's wrong with you guys? It's 1-866-687-7223.
I don't know. You know, maybe they're a little nervous about all this modern phone technology.
I don't. Here's what I hear, because people send me notes about my continuing to drive for the use of the toll-free line. So, number one, they don't have any desire to hear themselves on the radio at all, which is probably different than my generation. And the other thing is, many of them are intimidated by the expertise of the guest, or maybe me going off on one of my famous rants. So if they do it by email, they don't have that intimidation issue.
Right. And no risk that you'll tell them they're idiots.
I know. I never call them idiots, but I do.
I know, but
maybe they pick that up in my tone. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what Don is saying is David also includes in his rants on this subject to absolutely know the assumptions being used by the people presenting an idea to you or a concept or a business plan, and to figure out how to test their assumptions for reasonableness. And if you're not able to get a hold of their assumptions or test them and somehow believe that they're reasonable, it's not something you probably want to be involved with. Do you agree with that on assumption making?
Oh, yeah. I always ask people, I don't want to see a chart of numbers. I want to see the assumptions you're using. You know, how much... This was in a different area. It was a medical thing, but it was a yearly payment. And I said, okay, so what's your assumption about how many people re-up after the first year? And he said, oh, it's like 95%. I said, I haven't seen that in almost any business, except maybe paying your taxes. And so we had a really interesting conversation. He went back and redid his numbers and came back with a plan that was much more realistic and investable. But you know, you have to understand, it's just like when you do something, you know, in engineering, where are the stresses? Where are the vulnerabilities? Where the windshield meets the body of the spacecraft. It's always, you know, it's a very tender, delicate spot in the same place where these numbers, what are they based on? Are they realistic? If suddenly your costs went up by 5% because there was a shortage of titanium or something, what would happen? It's good to know that stuff.
You know, absolutely. Do you see that? I just wonder if a lot of people on the international legal side. So mm-hmm. I know, for example, that there are two meetings coming up through the UN to possibly consider modifying the Outer Space Treaty around Article 6, which is, for the most part, property rights or something of that nature. And a lot of the international community doesn't agree with what the U.S. did at the end of 2015 or what Luxembourg is doing. And I guess my question is, how much clout does the U.N. have on the direction it goes, or maybe international law, which doesn't track what we're doing in the United States, to some of the commercial ventures? Is that a warning sign that would keep people away? Is it something we need to take note of because it's a risk factor out there? How do you see this international trend, which is different than here in the U.S. or maybe Luxembourg?
I don't know enough to give a very knowledgeable answer. Based on what you said, we should definitely be paying attention. There's a lot of uncertainty in the political environment as a whole right now, and this is one part of it. And I would say the U.S. is less, countries are less likely to say, oh, yes, the United States, whatever they want, they know everything. It's become a more fractious environment. But I don't have a very good, a useful answer. Just, yes, pay attention. Good question.
Pay attention. Okay. Wanda is in Phoenix, and listeners, there's 8 minutes left for you to use the phone, 1-866-687-7223. I'm probably shouting in the electronic wind here, but I do love the telephone, and so do our guests. So Wanda has a question and says, many space show guests over the years have transitioned from talking about STEM to STEAM. The big difference is that they're adding in arts and culture and things of that nature. I don't have any problem with that. In fact, I think it's probably a good idea. But I have a hard time getting my arms around any commercial potential with the STEAM concepts for going into space. What about you? Do you see any commercial potential on the STEAM side of things rather than STEM?
Well, so, I mean, first of all, I don't identify as focused mostly as an investor. I mean, I'm a customer. When you're living on Mars, I think you're going to want, you know, some art as well. How space-specific that'll be, probably not. I mean, but I guess the important thing to understand is the companies that are successful, and this is from an investor's point of view, are run by people who are good communicators. I mean, these human factors, the ability of people to enjoy art and to communicate with one another and to tell stories that will attract investors, you know, the arts and communication and being a human being matters a lot. And so I wouldn't dismiss art just because I can't figure out how to invest in it.
Is it in any way an enhancement for going into space, space settlement, maybe even expediting investment, knowing that it's a much fuller realm than just engineering and science, perhaps, or management?
Yeah, I mean, again, the reason for art, you know, if I'm selling space travel, yeah, I should have a space cabin that looks, you know, it's a place where people want to live. I mean, look at how much money hotels spend on making nice environments. And it's, you know, when my spacecraft is better than yours, yeah, it does matter. Are the seats comfortable? Are the windows nicely designed? You need attention to those kinds of things as well as just the engineering.
Okay. And do you, I guess, and we're coming up toward the end of the hour, listeners, but overall, if I were to say, actually, we have a telephone call, so I'm going to stop talking and take a caller.
At last.
Hold on.
Great.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Thank you for calling in spades. How are you, John?
Well, okay. Since you have much time, I just wanted to make this comment that the whole focus on STEM was because we have a deficiency of people going into it, I thought. And that was the issue, I thought, that was, at least that's the argument. I don't think we have any deficiency in the arts, and we have. You may, unless you want to talk about what you don't like the art they're doing, if that's the issue. But I mean, we have all kinds of movies, music. I don't think we're talking about just paintings in the traditional sense. The arts communities are pretty robust, and lots of people are trying to get into them. And it's also not something you really teach that much academically, anyhow. Really, it's do you have it or don't you, kind of. And I mean.
Well, there's graduate programs all over the place for art. Are you kidding?
True, but does any of those? But that's certainly not the people that are the most successful in the field, is it?
Whereas in
science, you pretty much have to have a science degree. In engineering, you have to pretty much have an engineering degree, right?
But, no, they all have arts degrees, and have a lot of them. You know, have. I mean, I think many of them are very well educated people, and they've actually come from other fields. Including Alan Bean, who is a world-renowned artist who walked on the moon.
Yeah, former President Bush. But, I mean, what I'm getting at is, I'm just saying, I don't see that is an area that doesn't have a lot of robust interest in the country. I thought the other was the fact we were trying to get more people into it. The other, I think, is there's a lot of people would like to be the movie star, the rock star, the movie producer, the director, whatever field you're talking about, or just doing paintings, I guess, whatever, photography. I mean, it seems like that has its own momentum and doesn't really need too much stimulation. Just my thought.
Yeah, that's a reasonable thought. But, I mean, the thing I was answering was, is there, and maybe that wasn't the question, so apologies if so, but what I was responding to was, is there a need for the arts in space? And I think absolutely yes.
Oh, sure. I mean, I guess, of course, I'm not denying that. Well, okay. I just thought I'd make that observation. I just find
right.
The trains are bringing that into what was otherwise a motivation to get more people into the, you know, hard sciences, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's more like space should be not trying to get more people into the arts, but trying to get more people from the arts.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll vacate and let you finish up the show.
It's good you called, because that way we understood your question and I understood that I was answering the wrong question. So two-way communication is always best, whether in space or on Earth.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, that opens the line if anyone wants to try to get in real quickly. We're pretty much at the end of our hour, Esther. What should we have talked about, or what have we missed, or what would you like to add in?
Yeah, really, in a sense, my message is, even though it's in space, it still requires common sense. Yeah, you still need good management. You still need to question your assumptions and all those things. And it's more important to understand. You know, you need to understand the basics of space and have someone around you who does, but at the same time, you do not need to lose hold of your common sense. You know, ask the boring questions. Does this plan make sense? Is the management capable of carrying it out? do the team work together well effectively? That kind of stuff is ultimately just as important as the specifics of the technology or a lot of the other things. In any business, there's ultimately most likely going to be a number of competitors, and the winners are going to be the ones that implement most effectively.
You got another phone call. Can you stay an extra minute
sure,
or two
sure.
and take it? Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
This is Marshall.
Go for it, Marshall.
I was listening to John earlier, and I have a slightly different question from what John was pointing out, and that is, who is the art for? If it's, you know, the cabin design of the spaceship, the engineer types generally aren't all that interested in the shape of the, you know, the shape of the furniture or the shape of the window and so on like that. They're after the hard data of science, which is what they get most interested in, which is not generally considered too artsy.
But if they want the people who present the data, who you know, do the infographics and make the data meaningful, they actually do need to understand art and presentation and have communication skills. So it varies. You're absolutely right. The people flying the spaceships, no. But the people...
Well, the key thing I'm kind of thinking is that those people going to colonize the moon and Mars are going to be the super techie types. Now, when they get the data and, you know, this and that and the accomplishments, then you are absolutely correct. You have to have the people that can take the data and turn around and present it back to, you know, the people of the world to say, hey, we're doing great things and you should support us, which is an art form unto itself right there.
Right. Well, they actually need to do that earlier. They need to do it when they're raising money. They need to tell a compelling story to the investors and help them understand the assumptions and the that kind of stuff. I mean, if you look at your standard investment deck right now, it, the good ones actually look pretty good.
You know, Marshall, when not to give any authenticity to Mars One, but when they selected their 100 people, I interviewed quite a few of them. Not everyone was willing to come on the show, but some of them talked to me, and I didn't interview any that were techies. So they had normal kind of jobs, and they were men as well as women, and they had families. And they were really troubled by the fact that they would never see their families again, but they also really wanted to do the Mars experience and go to Mars. And they didn't feel like they had to make that decision right away. They could go through the process and then sort of make it down the road. But they were not techies. And, you know, when I have met authors, they tell me that literature will go with people to Mars, and so will music. And, you know, musical instruments maybe if they figure out how to carry the added mass. And stuff like that. So when I think of STEAM, it's the artist helping to contribute to making space settlement and space development an even better and more enhanced and robust experience. And I do think people care, and I don't think it's just techies that want to deal with this stuff. I think that the techies also read books and go to concerts and symphonies and operas and plays and things like that. So it's a mixed bag, and I think including the arts makes the whole process much more human and much more deliverable as an end product for everybody. I mean, that's my view on it.
Yeah, you're both kind of pointing off that you don't see the people colonizing the moon and Mars as being like the people going to the International Space Station.
That's right. Over time, it's going to change.
No, but look,
yeah.
Those guys take guitars up there and play music,
yeah.
And they when they come back, they are engaged in you know, in arts things, and so. They're not just engineers or scientists. They're not monodimensional. You know, probably there's not a lot of art in the design, but there's certainly probably efficient design on the space station. But I think if they were going to go live someplace, they would absolutely want to bring culture and arts with them.
Enjoy this. Keep it up.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Thank you.
And I have one more email from Adrian for you.
Okay.
I think your guest has the right idea. Synthetic biology as a prime example and all forms of genetic engineering, especially as applied to humans, will play a major role in ultimately allowing some form of humanity to settle our solar system. However, currently, international governments and most cultures that rule nation states severely limit, discourage, and even criminalize many of these activities. Irrational belief phobias against GM crop foods are widespread, and many laws restrict human embryo experimentation, even for medical therapies. How do you see those technologies arise out of the forbidden realm to any degree of maturity without some kind of underground scientific financing and involvement?
So there's a huge difference between fooling around with human embryos and genetically modified crops, which are, in fact, mostly legal. I think to some extent, you know, maybe the more they become suspicious of them on Earth, the more important it will be the work we do with genetic engineering for use in space. I mean, if things really got a lot worse, then I would say you can sort of say I'm working on this. I wouldn't do this on Earth, but I'm doing it for space or something like that. So I'm not that concerned about that. I see a lot of it happening. There's a great conference called SynBio Beta, Synthetic Biology, actually run by a guy called John Cumbers, who used to work at NASA Ames. And they're doing fine. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of startups. And, you know, so I'm not honestly that concerned.
Well, I'm honestly not that concerned about that at this point in time either. And I guess we'll see how things evolve down the road.
Yeah.
I do think there are a lot of excessive fears and phobias and and sort of...
I'm going to make a joke, but, you know, we'll see how things get genetically engineered down the road, not just let them evolve.
I think we have too much of that in our culture, and the best tool against that is education, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're winning the educational battle. So,
yeah. Not right now. That's probably the most important thing, you know, beyond space travel. Just if we have an educated population, it would be a real win.
Absolutely. Have you thought of teaching classes to students?
I think I can leverage myself better in other ways. I mean, I talk to kids from time to time. And, of course, I'm appearing on the space show.
Absolutely, but I was thinking of going before a middle school or a high school class.
Yeah, I did chat with actually some high school kids just last week at an event in Washington. So, well, yeah, to the extent it turns up as an opportunity, I do it with enthusiasm, because you're right. They're the ones that matter, the next generation.
Absolutely. Any other concluding comments or anything you want to add to what you said before I read Adrian's message?
No, but I look forward to someday doing this from Mars, where phone calls will be impossible, questions will be prepared in advance.
Yeah,
for the terrestrial audience, at least.
Phone calls will be impossible. Well, I'm 71.
Real-time phone calls.
Yeah, I'm 71, so mm-hmm. we gotta get on the stick if we're going to make this happen. Absolutely. Thank you for coming back to the space show, and we've really enjoyed and appreciated your insights. And we look forward to talking to you again down the road, and I'll look forward to seeing you at another conference or event down the road as well.
Thank you very much, and have a great Sunday.
Thank you, and all of you, thank you for listening. And look at the schedule for the week coming up. Dennis Wingo is on tomorrow, and the rest of the schedule is on the website. Everybody have a great rest of the week, and thank you for your a couple of phone calls and for all of your emails. Special thanks to Esther Dyson, and goodbye from her, myself, and the Space Show.